books can really make an impact on a child. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller today. He's got a sick furnace. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. In the studio with me is Mary Lindgren. She's a librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center, or CCBC, as a lot of people refer to it. And that's in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She has a list of children's book recommendations just in time for the gift-giving season. So what questions do you have about choosing a children's book? Have you discovered a great new book this year? Well, we want you to be part of the conversation. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send an email to us. And that email address is ideas@wpr.org. Mary, thank you so much for coming in. You have a nice stack of books that I am very much looking forward to seeing. But first, why don't you tell us about the Cooperative Children's Book Center? What do you do there?
Sure. So the Cooperative Children's Book Center is a library of the School of Education on the UW-Madison campus. We also get funding from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. So that means we have a really wide constituency. So we have students and faculty, mostly education students, library school. And then we also, through the DPI, serve all teachers, school, and public librarians in the state of Wisconsin. So we do a lot of outreach around the state.
Definitely. So what is your position there as a librarian?
I'm a librarian. Mm-hmm. We are first and foremost all about books. Yep. We receive just about every book published in the United States for children and teens every year, gets sent to us as review copies by publishers, and we read a lot of them. Uh-huh. And end up coming up with typically about 250 books we recommend every year in our annual Best of the Year list called CCBC mm-hmm. Choices.
And how do you willow those down?
Oh, it's challenging.
Gotta be hard. Yeah.
We all read books. There's four librarians on staff, and then we have long, sometimes heated, often funny conversations where we sort of have to come to consensus on those that we think are the very best.
Sure.
We're always looking for excellence in writing and literary styles, but then we're also looking for books that we know are needed, that people are looking for. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of different goals that we're trying to reach.
What makes a good children's book?
Well, just like what makes a good adult book.
Okay.
It's going to be well-written. It's going to have all those things we know, like plot and character development and a really well-developed thesis. It's also going to appeal to the audience that it's looking for. So, you know, whether that's really young children, preschoolers or elementary school or high school. So it has to be compelling mm-hmm. to that audience. But I think often people are really surprised by the level of sophistication that young readers can handle and actually really relish.
And what about the illustrations? Because obviously with a younger children's book, mm-hmm. especially, that's so important.
Really important. Mm-hmm. So again, we're looking for sort of overall artistic quality. And both in the illustrations and in the text, we're also looking for authenticity and people who are really know what they're writing about. Just like in an adult book, you don't want any inaccuracies. You want it to be accurate. And we're always looking for books for a diverse audience and books that reflect the diversity of our world.
Sure. So what kind of trends have you seen in the market in the last few, I don't know, a decade or so?
Yeah, that's interesting. It does go in trends.
Yeah.
There's sort of cycles. So, you know, 10 years ago, I'd say there was more picture books. Lately, we've been seeing a lot of books for young adult readers and middle grade. Think about the impact of books that have been around for a while, like Harry Potter.
Right.
But those really had big impacts on publishing, with publishers trying to kind mm-hmm. of find the next big hit like that. Some really excellent picture books, and also some great books by smaller presses that often have a little bit more freedom in what they're doing. So we really kind of appreciate that whole wide market that we can look at.
And was it a good book, a year for books this year?
It was.
It was. It was.
Yay.
I gotta say, though, I pretty much always think that. But yeah, definitely.
So you've got a few books here of the many that you selected for your list of 250. You know, a lot of them will have age ranges on that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really important?
Well, that's a great question. Yes and no. I mean, everybody wants a starting place, but mm-hmm. I always caution people to not get too locked into that, because if you have a young reader who's highly interested in a topic, they can often read well above what you might consider to be their reading level. And also books that might be easy to dismiss because you say, oh, they're pretty short, there's not a lot of text, they can be incredibly sophisticated in their content and what they ask of the reader. Mm-hmm. So we do put a suggested, what we see as a suggested age range on each of the books we recommend, but we always say, you know, if it sounds interesting, if it sounds like your reader or you have a child in your family who you know is interested in that topic, give it a try.
Okay. So let's just take a look at the list. Now, the very first one, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, did she send me adult books? Because that is an interesting topic for a children's book. Tell us about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. So this is Games of Deception, the true story of the first U.S. Olympic basketball team at the 1936 Olympics in Hitler's Germany. This is by Andrew Moranis, just came out this year, 2019, published by Philomel. And I would say this is probably targeted at middle school. So think kind of young teenagers, but a perfect example of a book that could either go younger, definitely could go older. I have to say it's a book I haven't been able to stop thinking about since I read it, because it really does a number of things. Mm-hmm. So it kind of combines a history of basketball as a sport as the book opens up. And then it goes on to show how it ended up becoming an Olympic sport actually pretty quickly after it first appeared. And then it takes just a really interesting and deep look at the ethical issues that surrounded the U.S. participation in the 1936 Olympics. So it does things like looks at the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, a man named Avery Brundage, who was just blatantly anti-Semitic. He was really determined that Americans were going to participate in these Olympics, and he worked in this country and in Germany to help ensure that. And then he looks at how the Olympics were, in that term we see in the title, they were really a deception. It was not all about international sportsmanship and unity. It really, those Olympics were driven as a way to showcase German power. And there was so much going on behind the scenes, and there was all of this militaristic might that was on display, and were really warning signs of things to come in the years after. And then it takes us all the way to the final game. That final game, it's between the United States and Canada. It was played in pouring rain on a sunken outdoor tennis court that was filled with at least 2 inches of standing water by game time.
Oh, my gosh.
It says dribbling was impossible. The ball was so slippery, they could hardly hold on to it. The final score? Well, the U.S. won 19-8.
Oh my gosh.
So it is just, it's so compelling with all of these different elements, including like sort of almost color commentary on the games. But I think in the in its true impact, really looking at these issues of discrimination in Germany, but also in the U.S. and sort of all of those forces coming together at those pivotal Olympic games.
Yeah, that sounds like a book that would appeal to a lot of different people.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would give it to an adult with an interest.
Yeah, I want to read it. Seriously, you leave that for me, right?
You can borrow it from your public library.
Oh, that darn library. They always want them back.
That's so true.
It's so true. Okay, well, great. Let's go to the next one then. And the next couple are kind of space-related books, aren't they? Is space still popular with kids?
It is definitely, and there have been some big anniversary years for various space events that have, I think, have sort of driven publishing. And this next book is from really for a younger audience. It's called The Astronaut Who Painted the Moon. It's actually by a Wisconsin author. Dean Robbins lives right here in Madison, illustrated by Sean Rubin. And it's a picture book format. It introduces the astronaut, Alan Bean. He traveled to the moon in 1969 with the Apollo 12 mission. He was actually the fourth person to walk on the moon. So the first part of that book takes us up to that point. And then it also talks about his interest in art. So after he gets back from that trip, and you know, his friends start asking him, well, what was it like up there on the moon? And then it moves into how he really answered that question, and he used it with his art to share that experience. The book describes the processes he used, how his imagination, his really creative use of color was a big important part of it. He did things like he stamped on his painting with his astronaut boots to leave the imprint. Yeah. He sprinkled dust from his spacesuit onto some of the wet paint, so this really textural thing. And it's just so fascinating. And then there's a couple pages at the end that include photos from his mission and then show the artwork that he created to interpret that very same scene with his really distinct style.
Yeah, and I believe, if I recall, that mission took place like 50 years ago today, right?
So this is one of those anniversary books. Yeah. Actually, Dean Robbins was able to interview Alan Bean writing this book right before he died. He just died last year.
Okay.
And he came out with this great quote that's included in the book where Alan Bean said, "I think of myself not as an astronaut who paints, but as an artist who was once an astronaut."
Oh, I love that.
I love that intersection of science and art.
Yeah, for sure. So do we know any other books from Dean Robbins that we would recognize?
We do, but I am not going to cite a title and get it wrong.
You librarian.
he's a relatively newer writer, and he is doing some great stuff, and he often is doing sort of historical social justice issues or is one of the things he's related in. But contact your public library or the CCBC and we'll be happy to give you those exact titles.
Can't tell them everything, right? And what's the other, the next one now? That one is Astro Girl.
Yeah, I just thought I would mention that too because of the related theme. This is by Ken Wilson Max. And this is probably one of the youngest audience that I brought with me today. This is a great book for preschoolers. It features this little brown-skinned girl named Astrid who wants to be an astronaut. And so we see her sort of talking about that desire with her dad. They're just at home. And she says, "I want to be an astronaut." And he says, "Are you sure? You'll have to go round and round the Earth in your spaceship." He swings her around, sort of holding onto her arms. And she says, "Oh, I can do that. Well, what about eating food out of a tube or a package every day?" "I can do that," said Astrid as she munched a cereal bar. "Okay, Astro Girl, you'll also have to get used to zero gravity." Papa threw her up in the air. "I can do that all day long," she says. So it's this really warm, positive interactions between this father and daughter. They're doing science experiments, which in this case is they make rocket ship cookies. And it's great fun. And then we get to a wonderful twist because on the last couple pages, they head out. They have to pick up Mama, and where they're picking her up is at the Space Center.
Of course.
Because her mother is an astronaut who's just returned from a mission, and obviously she's the model for Astrid's aspirations. Really love that ending.
That is great.
They also have a little page at the end where they introduce five other female astronauts from different countries and just sort of showing women in this field and, you know, fully expecting to see Astrid as one of them someday.
You know, and is that a trend, too? We had the author of Fry Bread on weeks ago, which is a lovely children's book also. And in the back, there was a lot of information about Native Americans and more of an adult version of the kids version. Right. Is that something that we see more of?
A lot. Actually, I laugh with my coworkers because we are such book nerds. We love that information at the end of a book that tells you more about the topic, often more about the creator, additional places to look for more information if this interests you. But it's not like, don't think textbook. It's not like dry and dull.
No.
It's equally compelling and often really visually interesting. Like in this case, they have little illustrated portraits of those female astronauts.
Okay. So they're not the pictures,
yes,
they're illustrated portraits.
That is happening more and more, and I appreciate it so much when I see it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's do one more before we go to the news. The next one up is another long title. Right This Very Minute, a Table to Farm book about food and farming.
That is a long one. And actually, it's another book by a Wisconsin author. So Lisa Dettelson lives near Wisconsin Rapids. And this book has a great phrase that it repeats over and over. So it starts out by saying, "What's that you say? You're hungry for breakfast? Right this very minute? Then you need a farmer." And that's sort of the approach on the remaining pages. So on the next few pages, we hear why. So right this very minute, a grower is testing an orange that will become orange juice to make sure it's ripe. Farmer's getting ready to plant wheat that will become flour for pancakes. And a sugar maker is changing out the buckets catching sap that will be turned into maple syrup. So then that pattern continues throughout the day. So it outlines why you need a farmer at snack time and lunchtime and dinner time and when you want dessert. So it shows how all of our food really is dependent on that knowledge and that hard work of the people who grow and tend it and process it and package
it. Sure, sure. Well, that would be a great book to send to someone who doesn't maybe live in Wisconsin, too, just, you know, who has relatives here or something like that.
Definitely. So,
great. Well, we've been talking with Mary Lindgren. She's a librarian at the CCBC. That's in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What questions do you have about selecting children's books? Do you have a favorite that you'd like to recommend to us? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back after the news. We're talking about some of this year's best children's books on the show today. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Mary Lindgren. She's a librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center, or the CCBC, in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she's been giving us some suggestions for books for kids of all ages. Are you looking for a book for a kid on your gift list? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, and you can send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. And we do have a couple of emails, so let's get to those right away, Mary. The first one is from Janice, and she asked, do you have a recommendation for a book for a 13-year-old boy with Down syndrome? He is a non-reader and verbally challenged.
Well, the first thing I think of when I hear that question is, absolutely, there are books for that child, readers and non-readers. As a librarian, we take it to heart that there is always a book that is going to be appealing. Without knowing more about this particular boy, I can't really recommend a specific book. One of the things that's really helpful is to, you know, are there any books that he has liked in the past? Or is there a subject that is interested? Or is there a style? Like, for example, do graphic novels or comics maybe work better than a straight narrative text? Or, you know, there's all kinds of ways to approach that. So I guess what I would recommend to her is think about answers to those questions. And then really a great resource, I mean, I know it's going to sound obvious, but public library is a great place to go and to ask for some suggestions.
And most of them have a children's librarian that
absolutely
knows their inventory back and forth, right?
For sure.
That's actually a good tip for anybody trying to find a book for someone, I would think, right? Another email came in from Brooke, and she is in Portage. She says, do you know of any nonfiction chapter books about animals and or sea creatures? She says her 9-year-old daughter loves nonfiction books about animals and sea creatures, but she'd like to get her books with more information about individual creatures rather than little snippets.
Another great question. It actually takes me to a book, a relatively recent book a couple years ago that I loved, called The Octopus Scientist, Exploring the Mind of a Mollusk. Maybe the, you know, the best subtitle ever. The author is Cy Montgomery, and it really does look at the current scientists who are studying octopuses and learning so much from them and actually realizing how much we don't know about them.
They're amazing.
Absolutely. Really wonderfully illustrated with photographs. This book is part of a series published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt that's called Scientists in the Field. There's a number of different authors, including Cy Montgomery, who have written for this series. The quality varies from book to book, but overall, many of them are excellent. We have recommended several from the CCBC. So if you take a look at The Octopus Scientist and that is appealing, then you might want to check out other books in this series. There are actually dozens.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I love the way that they, they not only provide information about whatever scientific subject is being studied, often animals, but they also really give young readers a way of imagining themselves as a scientist and sort of seeing the path that current scientists took to get to their job.
Yeah, real neat. Now, you weren't exactly sure of who the exact title was, so we went on the CCBC website to find it. So tell us about the listings that you have. And
so we do have a website that's about to be redesigned, so everything I tell you is hopefully going to change fairly soon. But it is a website primarily designed for the teachers and librarians who turn to us first, but anyone can use it. We do have, if you click on the tab that says books, you can come to specialized subject book lists that we've developed of books we've recommended on a certain topic. But you also can just search. There's a search box in the upper right corner of our home screen, and you can enter a word of whatever the topic it is or the title that you want to hear more about, and click on description, and it will take you to books that we have recommended in the past.
Okay, great. Well, let's go to the phones. Avi, I believe we have on from Oxford. Hi, Avi.
Hi.
What's your question?
Okay, I don't have a question, but you were asking for recommendations for children books.
Yes.
That were published this year. Well, I am very partial to one that was just published by my daughter. And it's called Walk Through Mushroom Town. And it's based on a story that my children came up with when they were little. And now they're adults. And so my son wrote the story and my daughter illustrated it. And it's for children ages 3 to 6, so little kids with lots of great illustrations. And it's a really cute story. When my children were little, they always used to draw as I read aloud to them.
Uh-huh.
And my son was drawing little mushroom, and I bumped his elbow accidentally, and a mouse was created through this mushroom.
Oh.
And so this little character of this mushroom came alive, and they wrote tons and tons of stories about this little mushroom that used to mine, and it's really cute. Anyway, now my daughter is 26, and she finally decided to publish this one of a series that they intend to do. And so brother and sister are doing in a collaboration. Like,
oh well, what a lovely story! What's the name of it? Name of it again?
It's called A Walk Through Mushroom Town.
A Walk Through Mushroom Town. Okay.
Yeah, they're self-publishing on Amazon, and they sell it on Etsy, too.
Well, great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That sounds like a fun book.
And congratulations to your whole family. It sounds like it was a great group effort.
Very exciting. Yeah. Thank you, Avi. Let's go on to Judith, and she's in Brookfield. Hi, Judith. What's your question?
Yes, I have a grandson who's 14 years old and interested in architecture, wants to become an architect into that. And I'm wondering if that's too young to find a book and how I would go about that.
Well, there are some books that immediately pop to mind that have been published that I think would be could be really appreciated by a 14-year-old about architecture. There's an author, also the illustrator of the books. His name is David McCauley, and there are several. They're really sophisticated in appearance, so they even though they're illustrated, they don't look like books for really young children, so they have sort of schematic drawings and cross-sections in them. One that I remember of his that I especially like is called Castle, where he's actually, you know, exploring the architecture of castles. Some are of more current forms of architecture. So I think anything by him would be interesting. I think also we talked about the CCBC website earlier. You could go to that website and enter the word architecture and see what books you come up with. I know there are more. But if you're looking more for a book that might talk about becoming an architect or heading into the field of architecture, I think that would be a great public library question.
Okay, thank you for that question, Judith. Mary, let's get back to that list. Next one, we've got someone from a favorite author who's been with us a few times, and the book is called Sweeping Up the Heart.
And it's a wonderful new book by Madison author Kevin Henkes, who writes picture books and illustrates and also writes really wonderful novels. This is about a seventh grader. It's a girl named Amelia. She lives in Madison, Wisconsin. And she is kind of excited because for the first time in a while, her public school spring break actually aligns with her father's UW break. He's a professor, and she's like, Florida, let's go. And he says, no, actually quashes that, and he tells her they're going to stay in Madison. So she's disappointed. She realizes she'll spend much of the week at the ceramic studio in her neighborhood. She's a really wonderful budding artist. And when she arrives at the beginning of spring break at the studio, she's kind of unsettled because there's a new boy there. His aunt actually owns the studio. He's really talkative. He keeps interacting with her, kind of infringing on her space. But they end up having lunch together, and they bond when they start making up stories about the people that they see passing by. And it's really lighthearted, but that feeling starts to evaporate for Amelia when this boy, when Casey suggests that one of the women could be, you know, like an incarnation of Amelia's mother who died when Amelia was just 2 years old. And it leaves her feeling really unsettled and uneasy. And that kind of grows when she starts seeing this woman around the neighborhood and even sees her having a conversation with her dad. And Amelia begins to wonder if it might not actually be her mother.
Oh, dear.
She soon discovers, of course, it's not. It's a woman. Her name is Hannah. Amelia's father's been seeing her, but was calling it off because he was afraid the relationship would hurt Amelia. And when Amelia first meets Hannah, she really likes her. And she starts to get a glimpse of the future potential for having another adult in her life. And her dad, meanwhile, who so clearly loves his daughter but has a hard time really showing that, their relationship isn't very close, he really begins to see her in a different light. And so what we start to see is their relationship at the end of this spring break week is in a different place, and it's a relationship that's going to continue to open up and to change. Kevin Hankus has such insight when he writes about the interior worlds of children and young teenagers, never, you know, like in a big showy way, but in this incredibly finely crafted way that is also
subtle
and so readable and relatable. This is a book that we said would work really well for ages 8 to 12. So kind of a big expanse there, and could, I think, might even work as a read aloud for slightly younger, and definitely could have appeal. The main character is in seventh grade, so I think the appeal could go older.
Sure, because they're chapter book. It's a chapter book.
Yes,
yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds like a really, really good book. Next up, we have got More to the Story.
And More to the Story. So this is another new book published by Salaam Reads. It's written by Hannah Khan. It's a contemporary novel about four Muslim Pakistani-American sisters. And it mostly centers on the seventh grader, Jamila. She goes by Jam. She aspires to be a journalist. In fact, she's the features editor of her school newspaper. And then there's her three sisters, her older sister, Miriam, who's very responsible and beautiful and caring. There's her younger 11-year-old sister, Bisma, who's pretty quiet. She looks up to Jam. And then there's the youngest, Aliza, who kind of gets on Jam's nerves. So if you're listening carefully, you might begin to notice some parallels between this book and one that's been around for quite a while. It's another book about four sisters with very similar traits and characteristics. We know them as Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, because this is a contemporary retelling of Little Women.
Okay.
So one of the things I love about this book, you don't have to have any familiarity with Little Women in order to enjoy this one completely. Mm-hmm. But if you do, it's a great layer of added pleasure. This family, much like the Marches, are going through some financial worries. The dad has taken a job in Abu Dhabi where he's going to have to go live for the next 6 months. They really miss him. But the crux of the plot revolves around Jam. She's been assigned to write a newspaper article about a new eighth grader British boy who's come to the U.S. to live. And she learns when she's interviewing that he's experienced some of the same microaggressions because he's Muslim as she has. And she decides to take that angle in her article, using her and his anecdotes to illustrate it. But when he sees the draft, he says, no, I really don't want you to print that. And she's disappointed, but she writes another version. But through an accident, that first version is the one that's published.
Yeah.
So she has to figure out how she's going to apologize to him and how she's going to deal with that, really, that breach of journalistic ethics. So it's really fascinating. At the same time, you sort of knew this was coming if you're a Little Women fan. She's also dealing with her little sister Bisma's health issues, which turn out to be really scary and serious. But the friends, including Ali, this boy she's interviewed in the community, really rally around as her sister goes through treatment. So it's really fun, fast-paced. Each of these sisters has a distinct voice and a personality, really like the family and the larger social dynamics that are really spot on in this contemporary book.
Now, would the ages for a book, that book and the ages for Little Women coincide?
What a great question. You know, this book, I'd say, has a narrower audience. If you remember Little Women, the book two section of it takes them into their adulthood.
It does.
Meg
yeah.
has mm-hmm. children. Joe's finally getting into a romantic relationship. There's all of that going on. This is a little bit more like the book one section of Little Women. And I think this is another book that can work really well for upper elementary into middle school.
Okay. So possibly this book might be good first and then the actual Little Women.
Yeah,
a little bit
give it
later,
a try.
Maybe?
Or the
yeah.
other one. Now there is a movie version, a new movie version of Little Women coming out
yes.
this month or next.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that will kind of increase interest for a lot of people. It'd be great to pair this.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, and then we've got Stepsister.
Yeah, totally different. So now I'm moving into the young adult end
okay.
here. So this is following a really popular trend we've seen recently, and that's taking a familiar folk or fairy tale that you usually think of as being for young children and expanding it into a novel that's much weightier for older readers.
So let me guess, Cinderella?
Yeah, how did you know?
I am so smart.
This is a book that opens with a chapter that definitely guaranteed to grab your attention. We meet Isabel. She is cutting off her toes at her mother's urging because she is determined to fit her foot into the glass slipper and claim a life with the prince. It only works really briefly because her blood stains pretty much give her away. And it's her stepsister, Ella, who heads off for that happily ever after life. I really like this version because it has the traditional fairy tale, but then it gives these events some unexpected nuance and context. So Ella is, in fact, she's lovely and she's kind, and she was mistreated uh-huh. by her stepmother mm-hmm. and stepsisters. But Isabel, that stepsister, and her sister Tavi have their own misfortunes. They're judged by their looks. They're the ugly stepsisters, their failure to attract husbands, their strengths. Like Isabel's interested in military history. Tavi's all about science and math. Well, that's completely just sort of disregarded or denigrated. So
sure.
there's really a lot about feminism in here and expectations for female beauty
mm-hmm.
And behavior. The pieces all fit together at the end, including Isabel's knowledge of military strategy is very important to the plot. And she really gains agency in this book and learns
okay.
What she truly loves.
And for those concerned about the toes thing, that yeah. was in the original
you know,
fairy tale.
A lot of fairy tales are very dark
yes,
and have
they
some serious elements. And
yeah.
this is, as I said, this is a young adult novel.
Uh-huh.
So this is a book that I would say is for, you know, 13 and up.
Sure. And they read much worse. So, okay. And then we've got Frankly in Love.
Yeah.
What's that one about?
So this is another young adult novel. This is by David Yoon. Frankly, in the title, is spelled F-R-A-N-K-L-I, but it's actually about Frank Lee, L-I. And Frank is a high school senior. He's a first-generation Korean-American. His parents own a convenience store in a really sort of poor urban neighborhood. They live about an hour away in their suburban home. And a lot of this book explores really interesting issues of racism. Frank's best friend is Black, but he doesn't come over to Frank's house very often because Frank's parents are not particularly accepting of him. His older sister went away to college. She became a lawyer, and she's really pretty much estranged from her parents right now because she married a Black man. So knowing all of this, Frank can only imagine how his parents would react if they know that he's dating Brittany, a white girl, if the name didn't give it away. They've been very clear in their expectations that he'll end up with a nice Korean girl, preferably one who attends the monthly social gathering of five different Korean families who met years ago back in Seoul, and now they're all living in Southern California. Well, coincidentally, there's another teen at the gatherings, Joy, and she's in a similar predicament. She's been keeping her Chinese-American boyfriend a secret from her parents, so Frank and Joy hatch a plan. They're going to pretend to date each other, and then they'll actually head out with their secret romantic partners. Their parents will be happy. They'll be happy. What could possibly go wrong? Well, Everything, obviously, can go wrong. This book is hilarious. It has such funny and snappy dialogue and scenarios, but it's so much more than that.
Sure.
Because as Frank kind of works through this romantic swamp that he has himself in, he learns so much about his parents and about his friends and about himself. It's really insightful. It's nuanced, whether it's looking at those issues of race and racism that I touched on, immigrant families, relationships between parents and children, and of course, at the heart of it, love and romance.
Yeah.
You can't put it down.
Oh, wonderful. I think I might have to borrow that one from the library, too. And you know, we've got someone on the phone here. AJ's been waiting for a while. She's in Columbus. Hi, AJ. What's your question?
Hi. So I have a 12-year-old son who is in loves trains. Just love, love, love trains. So I wondered if there's any books you could recommend that he will be able to read. He's a very strong reader, and he wants to be a train engineer.
Well, that's, it sounds like he has a lot of direction already. So especially because you said he's a strong reader, I think some of the first books that are coming to mind are too young for him. So I think books often still are the topic of picture books for young children, you know, alphabet books, actually books for preschoolers. And I would love to come up with something that this 12-year-old who already has such a strong interest would find really interesting and appropriate. You know, again, I know I've said it before, you could try the public library. You could also email me at the CCBC. You can find my email address on our website. I have a feeling there's something out there that isn't really recent, but that might be great that will come to mind if you get in touch. I'm sorry, that's not an, I wish I could snap a title right off the top of my head for you, but I would love it if you got in touch and we could work on it.
Okay. Thanks for the question, AJ. Good luck with that. Now let's see, we've got a couple more that we haven't talked about yet. The first one is, how do you dance? Now, what age group is that for? Is that a younger?
So this is young. This is a, I think 32-page picture book, could work with preschoolers or young elementary age students. It opens up with that title question, how do you dance? And then it shows all kinds of people demonstrating their moves, except for one little boy who says, I don't. And then we go back to how others dance. Megs beckons, Koyo bops, Gilda flits, Aurora scrunches. you just move one part and then another, let it get weird, see where it goes. So it really celebrates dancing anywhere, anytime, no matter how you're feeling. And then finally we come back to that little boy who says, I don't dance like that. I want to be left alone. And the book says, well, understood, but just between us, how do you dance? And his reply is, I just told you. And then the turn on the final page, alone. And he is letting loose with some very impressive moves in the privacy of his bedroom. It's just
cute.
Really fun, not judgmental, celebrates dance in illustrations. I love that it shows people of all ages and sizes and body types and abilities. There's just a wonderful array of diversity, and they are all just doing their thing.
Okay. And then just quickly, one more, Home in the Woods.
Yeah, Home in the Woods by Eliza Wheeler, interestingly, is a story based on some experiences that her relatives went through in Bennett, Wisconsin in 1932. So this is about a family, a whole bunch of kids, eight of them, and their mother who move into a tar paper shack in the woods. And what this book really focuses on is their life together. They have very few resources. And how they still manage to have a good time together. She really encourages you to ask questions of older people in your family.
Excellent, excellent. And we are going to be putting a blog together, a blog post, and you can go to that on WPR/Larry to find out more on that list. And thank you for joining us. We've been talking to Mary Lindgren. I'm Jill Najo on the Ideas Network.